Soca, New Orleans Afro-Funk, Haitian Compa and Rara, and Antillean Zouk share the airwaves with African High Life, Afrobeat, Congolese Soukous, Malian Blues, Juju, and South African Kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fograng. And before we get to our guests, I got an announcement for fans of David Barsamian. He will be in, he will be speaking in Corvallis tonight. Tonight, December 5th, he will be in Corvallis at the Odd Fellows South Hall. And tomorrow night, Friday, December 6th, he will be in Salem at Willamette University in Cope Chapel. And both of those are at 7 p.m. So David Barsamian will be in your neighborhood. Okay, our guest today is Annie Michon. She was a former office intelligence officer with Britain's MI5, who back in the late 90s blew the whistle on all sorts of nefarious doings. She has written a book called Spies, Lies, and Whistleblowers. And she also has a website, which we will get to later. So, Annie, welcome to KABU.
Hi, Per. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Oh, very happy to. Why don't we start? You do have a website that people can get more information, right?
I do indeed, yes. It's just anniemichon.ch. So it's based in Switzerland, which seems to be one of the last countries that preserves privacy.
Oh, really?
Communications.
That's right. They do a lot of interesting things. They almost put a cap on executive salaries, but didn't quite make it.
Yes. Well, they're a very progressive society. I mean, they have a almost pure form of direct democracy, where local people can be invited to take part in referenda about any issue that is relevant to their local area, as well as at a national level. So they are very forward-looking. I mean, the Swiss have a certain sort of conservative reputation, perhaps, internationally. But, for example, they're very good on dealing with the war on drugs and the impact on their communities and things like that. So because they have this local direct democracy, they are much more humane in the way they treat people who use drugs.
Well, that's nice. Anyway, well, why don't we get right started? Let's sort of go back a ways. What did you do for MI5? You were an intelligence officer. What kind of duties did you have?
When you're recruited as an intelligence officer, you're recruited to run operations against targets. So you are given an area of responsibility, be it a terrorist group or a country of interest or whatever. You then have an array of secret methods to investigate that target, be it telephone taps, communications taps, following people around or running agents into those groups. And then you also receive all the information coming back from those sources that you deploy. And then you have to assess what that means, analyze what the next stages should be. Should it be arrest? Should you stop investigating someone or whatever? So it's quite a wide-ranging job.
Well, I noticed, kind of intrigued me, that one of the things that you blew the whistle on had to do with allowing IRA bombs to go off or something like that. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. I mean, this was interesting because I worked in the British intelligence in the 1990s. And at that point, the provisional IRA was seen as the major terrorist threat. And they were very effective. They were pretty much setting bombs and exploding bombs on UK streets at will. And MI5 took over the lead for the investigation into the Provisional IRA in 1992. And there were a number of operations in the early 90s where the police and MI5 made mistakes and allowed bombings to go ahead. And innocent people were killed. There was massive publicity for the Provisional IRA. There was massive damage to buildings and city centres and things. But the key thing was that even though they knew they'd made these mistakes, they then lied to the government to cover them up. And the government didn't have a clue that they hadn't got the full story. So on a number of levels, it was very troubling to see this sort of level of deception going on. And I think we see it even more today, where the spies can lie to our governments about what they're doing. And the governments really have no meaningful oversight. They have no real powers of investigation.
Was one of those bombs the one at Omagh?
No, this was earlier. There were two explosions that I and my former partner, David Shaler, who was the key whistleblower, were aware of. One was in Bishopsgate in the City of London in 1993, which was a massive lorry bomb, which caused about £350 million worth of insurance damage and also deaths on the streets. And another one was some bombs that were put on gas pipelines up in the far northeast of the UK, in Newcastle, which exploded. But fortunately, the lines weren't full of gas. Otherwise, they would have taken out the city centre. So both those cases were bungled by MI5 and the police. And in both cases, they lied to their political bosses to cover up their mistakes.
I wondered about the Omagh bombing, because in that case, Royal Ulster Constabulary had, I think they had a car parked not too far away. They were sort of allowing this to go on. This is what I heard. I used to co-host a Radio Free Ireland show here in KABU, so I got into some of this interesting stuff. But, that was a deadly explosion outside a tavern or something. A lot of people got killed, and there were allegations that the Royal Ulster Constabulary just let it happen.
Well, this happened after I left the service, but certainly there's been a lot of information that's made it into the public domain, showing that there had been warnings about an attack about to go ahead. And this was a bomb that went off in a high street in Omagh with no warning. And it was carried out by a dissident group, a splinter group, after the peace accord had actually been put in place in Northern Ireland. So it wasn't the old Provisional IRA.
This right.
One of the dissident splinter groups. And it caused massive carnage. I mean, many people killed, many people maimed. And yes, it does appear that there had been some warnings that something like that was going to go ahead. But the security services hadn't taken measures to protect people.
Yeah, because we are told that the provisionals usually warn people ahead of time, or warn the authorities ahead of time, so that bombs would go off without a whole lot of casualties. But, of course, it doesn't always happen that way. But what reason would the authorities have for allowing these to happen?
Well, it could just be sheer incompetence, of course.
I mean, yeah.
You know, someone didn't pass on a message or something, and then they lie and cover up their mistakes. Or it's not inconceivable. I don't think it's the case with this Omagh bombing, but it's not inconceivable that people allow attacks to go ahead because they want to maximize the political fallout afterwards in order to attain some sort of political agenda, and that does happen.
Well, let's get on to the the big event was this plot to assassinate Muammar Gaddafi.
Mm. Yes, this was the case that made us quit. We resigned MI5 and we blew the whistle and had to go on the run around Europe. So, and this was in 1997, so 16 years ahead of Edward Snowden going on the run. This was an appalling case because my former partner, David Shaler, was the head of the Libyan section in MI5 in 1994 to 96. And he was officially briefed by his counterpart in MI6, which is the Foreign Intelligence Gathering Agency. It's a bit like the CIA, who had been approached by a Libyan dissident, a Libyan military intelligence officer, who said that he had a ragtag group of Islamic extremists, as in Al-Qaeda, who wanted to try and get rid of Gaddafi. They needed help from MI6, including funding, in order to carry out this coup attempt. And MI6 leapt on this because they had these sort of James Bond views, you know, fantasies. They wanted to do something. So they started handing over huge amounts of money to this group. And the attack did indeed go ahead. Innocent people were killed. And the attack then turned out to be illegal under UK law. Now, most people think that James Bond's license to kill is probably mythical. But under the Intelligence Services Act 1994, Section 7, if MI6 gets the prior written permission of their political master, the Foreign Secretary, to do anything illegal abroad, up to and including murder, if they get that prior written permission, then they are immune from prosecution within the UK. In this case, they did not get that prior written permission. So what they did in Libya was not only immoral and unethical and highly reckless, it was also illegal under UK law. And that's what Lee resigned about, and that's what we blew the whistle about chiefly.
So what...
Of course, the sort of follow-up to that was that in 2011, when NATO intervened in Libya, it was the same scenario. We saw the CIA and we saw MI6 going in and funding and helping and arming the same group to try and depose Gaddafi, and this time they got him. You know, they caught him and they tortured him and they killed him.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference from the 90s, when that had to be done in secret, and in 2011 when it was done entirely openly in the full gaze of the world's media and nobody seemed to care at the time, I think is rather alarming. It shows a sort of moral slide for all of us, that we accept that that's what our secret agencies can do internationally.
Well, I just have to ask, what were they thinking when they did this? Because we see now, you know, that, they did get Gaddafi, and Libya now is being ruled by a big assortment of kind of local militias, and the country has really descended into chaos.
It was a predictable chaos as well.
Did they not see that that would be a likely outcome of getting rid of Gaddafi?
Well, you would think so after all the shambles of the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. I mean, no matter how odious a strongman dictator is in some of these countries, they often provide stability and they often actually provide a sort of protection against Islamic extremism. Gaddafi certainly did. I mean, he had more to fear from Islamic extremists than, you know, most Western countries. So they must have known. I presume they thought they'd go in and they'd be able to sort of take over the huge oil fields, and they get wonderful contracts, both in the mid-90s and also in 2011. Unfortunately, if you stabilize a country so much, like Iraq or like Libya, then it's not safe for the oil companies to go in and operate at full volume. So it's a self-defeating strategy, really, I think. And it's been interesting watching what's unfolded in Syria over the last year with the civil war there, where, again, our intelligence agencies from the UK and the US have been helping and arming and funding the Islamic extremist rebels to try and topple a so-called dictator. And it's not working this time, because everyone can see that we can't invade, we can't have a proper war, that it's going to just cause another huge mess in the Middle East and destabilize the region. But Syria, in this case, have powerful allies like Russia and China, who are at least putting the brakes on overt war, which is good.
I just wonder how much planning there was in this, because, you know, we have sort of pretty well known, at least the cable listeners, that back in 2001, right after 9/11, General Wesley Clark was visiting friends at the Pentagon. And one of his friends told him that, I guess it was Donald Rumsfeld's office, had this plan that they would overthrow seven governments in 5 years. And Iraq was on the list, Syria, Libya, and others. So, in other words, at least they were thinking along these lines well ahead of time. And you just wonder how much planning there was. You know, the sort of the official story is that the Syrian rebellion began with nonviolent protests that were horribly put down by the Assad government, and then it just kind of went on from there. But it looks to me like there was some sort of preparation for this. Do you have anything to add to that?
I'm sure there was, yes. I mean, getting people inside those countries to provoke those sort of demonstrations and then get the backlash is a standard technique. I mean, the CIA has been using it across the globe for decades. And there's no doubt that America certainly targeted the Axis of Evil group of countries that you referred to for not only energy gains, you know, to protect oil fields and gas fields and secure them for Western use, but also usually most of these countries, and this is quite an interesting sort of addition to the oil argument, most of them want to start trading their oil in currencies other than the dollar. So, of course, if that happened, it would pull the carpet out from under the U.S. economy. The petrodollar would use it, would lose its sort of monopoly around the world, and it would be a real problem for the U.S. So targeting countries that try and use either euros or rubles, or even, as Gaddafi was trying to do, establish a pan-African gold standard dinar currency, would be a huge threat to the American economy. So you can see why they would try and go into these countries, not just for the oil, but also to protect how the oil is traded.
Well, as Saddam Hussein was doing also. And I guess Iran is, the oil that they sell, they, I think they trade gold with Turkey for oil or something like that. But
well, Iran actually opened up a bourse to trade oil, and they announced this, I think, in 2004 or 5, where they wanted to start trading their oil in euros and rubles as well, as dollars, as petrodollars.
How is that
so
going?
You have a situation where suddenly Iran becomes this huge nuclear threat and they're sanctioned, you know?
Well, this is Fight the Empire. My guest is Annie Marchand, who is a British intelligence officer who quit and blew the whistle on some really nasty operations. And so let's get back to after you and David Shaler blew the whistle on the Gaddafi plot. You had to go into hiding then, or what?
Absolutely, yes. We went literally on the run around Europe. We fled the UK 12 hours ahead of the stories breaking in the national media. We spent a month on the run. It was like some sort of surreal backpacking holiday across Europe. And then I went back, and I knew I'd be arrested and questioned and all that. And our flat was smashed up in a counterterrorism-style raid. And many people around us, our friends and our relatives, were also intimidated by the police, the secret police. So it was quite a traumatic time to go through, even though we were the ones trying to report the crimes committed by the spies. Under UK law, though, if you are a serving or former intelligence officer and you talk about your work outside the intelligence world, you also become a criminal. So they went after us, always to try and shoot the messenger, rather than actually address the message, which was very serious. And to this day, they've avoided any inquiry into a whole range of things we disclosed. And I think this is rather sad, actually, because now we're in a situation where we see through the Snowden disclosures that our spy agencies are running amok. They're out of control, and they're doing whatever they can without any real meaningful oversight from our governments. And they've got away with it for so long, they think they can continue to get away with it. So this is why I think whistleblowers are important, because they say, actually, they shouldn't be doing this. This is illegal. And if our governments could actually listen to that as it happens and take steps to reform the intelligence agencies as these things happen, then we'd all be safer. Unfortunately, our governments are always very wary of trying to tackle the intelligence agencies.
Well, it's interesting, you know, before you're talking about different cases where, you know, intelligence has all kind of fostered, supported dissident groups in different countries. There was a story just came out the other day about there was a group called Otpor, which is sort of a Serbian group, and they were against trying to bring down the government of Mihailovic. And it turns out that the leader of that group was on the payroll, that the CIA was funding this group all the time as part of their Balkan strategy to break up Yugoslavia. And it had been alleged before and denied, but I guess it just came out the other day that this had really happened.
Well, no doubt about it. I mean, this is a very standard tactic. It's what the spies call controlled opposition. So they have what appear to be democratic grassroots campaigns, which they actually can control because they have a couple of people leading that campaign. And it's a very effective tactic, and they use it again and again. So it really is a sort of smoke and mirrors type environment, trying to work out who's doing what and why they're doing it. I think, though, that one of the good ways you can try and test who's effective, who's really doing what they should be doing, is the pushback that they receive. So, for example, if you get an organization which appears to be making a lot of noise, saying the right things, sounding very democratic, heading up a very high-profile grassroots activist group or something, but actually nothing ever changes, and nobody's ever penalised, that's it, then there may be questions around them. If you get a really serious group that challenges the authority fundamentally, so, for example, like with whistleblowers like Edward Snowden or Tom Drake or whoever, or with organisations that publish the material coming out of whistleblowers, such as WikiLeaks, or even The Guardian newspaper in the UK now, which is being threatened with prosecution for publishing the Edward Snowden disclosures. If you see that degree of pushback, that's usually a sign that these people are doing something right and that they're genuine. And I think that's quite a good acid test when looking at who's a genuine activist, who's not, or who might just be a bit of a careerist.
Do you think anything like this is happening in Ukraine right now?
Very likely, I think, yes. With the demonstrations, probably from both sides as well. I mean, Russia wants to ensure that its back door is kept safe. The EU wants to extend its influence. So I'm sure that both sides are doing the same thing.
You know, one thing, when you have so many kind of undercover, sort of compartmentalized groups operating, do you ever have any cases where one undercover group is kind of blowing the whistle on another one without knowing it?
I'm not sure about blowing the whistle, but certainly they can tread on each other's toes, shall we say. This happens quite regularly, and it happens because they are very wary of sharing information with each other as well. So it's almost like a bit the Keystone Cops, you know, they're all chasing around the same targets. And, I mean, I'm saying this almost as a joke, but it's not. It's actually deadly serious. For example, if someone goes into activism, they might want to go into a campaign, you know, something like Occupy or free internet stuff or whatever, and they're out there and they're waving a placard and they go on a demonstration, they're talking, you know, anti-war, whatever you want to say, there is a good chance that not only is the demonstration or the campaign going to be infiltrated by the official spies, it might be infiltrated by the police as well, and it will almost certainly be infiltrated by the commercial spies. These are the private corporations that spy, that are hired by other corporations to spy on activist groups that might cause damage or embarrassment to their interests. And they are growing exponentially, both in the US and the UK. It's a big growth industry. So, you know, you could go on a demonstration, there might be a chance that 25% of the people on the demonstration are reporting back to someone or another. It's actually quite worrying in terms of democracy.
Well, that's what they used to say about the lefty parties back in the 30s and 40s, that you could tell who the FBI spies were. They were the ones who were taking notes at meetings or something.
That's not far off, yes.
But what were some of the other things that have we missed some good items here? I mean, there was one, I think there was one case where a citizen in London had been shot down supposedly by people firing from the Libyan embassy. Was that for real, or was that sort of a bogus thing?
Oh, that. Yeah, that was a long time ago, I think 1984 or something. It was a WPC, a police officer, a female police officer, Yvonne Fletcher, who was shot from the Libyan embassy when Libya still had an embassy in London, then it was shut down. And there were all sorts of theories swirling around about, you know, was it the Libyans, was it the CIA, who knows? But the Libyans did, you know, basically admit eventually and pay reparation, I think. So it's a very dirty game. The whole Libyan relationship with the UK has been very mixed over many decades, with Yvonne Fletcher, with Lockerbie, with the Gaddafi plot in the 1990s to try and assassinate him. And then, of course, Tony Blair's infamous deal in the desert with the Gaddafi back in...
Oh, yes, I was going to ask you about that. Tell us about that.
Well, the whole thing stank, basically. I mean, you have a situation where the Prime Minister knows that MI6 has tried to assassinate this guy, and then he goes oiling his way in to try and make contracts and peace with this person. He also knows, of course, the back history of Gaddafi, who was a big funder of terrorist organizations. I mean, don't get me wrong. In the 70s and 80s, he funded Adam Udall, he funded the Provisional IRA, you know, all those sort of groups. So it was a very weird meeting, I should think. But then, of course, at around the same time, we have a situation where MI6 in 2004 is then extraordinarily rendering or kidnapping terrorist suspects that Libya wants back in Libya to torture and to try and get information from. And there's a very famous case, a man called Abdel Hakim Belhaj, who was kidnapped from the Far East, taken to Libya as a gift by MI6, handed over to the Gaddafi regime and tortured for 60 years. And it was only when Gaddafi was overthrown that Belhaj was freed. And then it emerged that MI6 had handed him into the Gaddafi regime like a sort of turkey on a platter.
It was a gift
because they had the deal in the desert in 2004. I mean, that's really sick. The irony being that Belhaj is now a senior military commander in the new regime in Libya, in Tripoli, and he's suing MI6 and the foreign secretary and the senior MI6 officer who were involved in his kidnapping. So that's one to watch, I think, in the UK news.
Oh, wow, I will. Well, you know, another example would be with Syria, you know, where the U.S. sent this fellow Maher Arar, who was a Syrian. He was born in Syria, but he became a Canadian citizen, and he was coming back from a vacation, and his plane was refueling at JFK Airport in New York, and he was on the plane, and I guess the FBI came on there. They took him off the plane, and then they sent him to Syria, where he was tortured for about a year or something before he was finally released.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, if we think Assad is such a bad, odious person, which he probably is, why do we do things like that? Why do we cooperate with him in that sense or use him for our purposes?
Well, I mean, he was seen as a bit of an ally. I mean, the irony being that his father seized power in Syria a few decades ago and was a bit of a strongman, sure. And his eldest brother was always assumed to be the person who'd take over when his father died. His eldest brother died. So Assad was happily living in leafy North London, working in his profession. He was an eye surgeon in North London, and suddenly gets a call back to Syria to take over as, you know, the new favorite Middle Eastern despot. Talk about a job change. I do feel for that in a way. So he sort of fell into it in a sort of strange sort of way, but he was seen as a Western ally, a Western friend for a while because of that, because he was seen as westernized. So the way he's being demonized now is interesting. And, of course, we can see why they're doing it, because of the power balance in the Middle East.
Well, what are you doing now? I mean, you wrote a book a few years back. Have you got any more books coming out or anything?
Oh, well, if I ever get the time, yes, I have a wonderful book I would love to write. But at the moment, I'm very busy doing a lot of public speaking and also campaigning around whistleblower issues and the war on drugs for an organization called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And on the whistleblowing front, I'm very involved with the Edward Snowden Defense Fund. If anyone's interested in trying to support the guy and help him with his legal fees, it's a wonderful website, which is freesnowden.is. And what I'm going to be doing is sort of broadening that out to help future whistleblowers too. So please watch this space and have a look at my website just to make sure that, you know, to see what's going on and when things are announced.
So let's see, that's freesnowden.is. What?
IS. Iceland. Yeah.
Oh, IS for Iceland. Okay. Yeah. And your website is what?
AnnieMichon.ch.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being with us. I wish we could go on and unearth some more interesting stories. Maybe we can do that in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Annie Michon, who is an intelligence officer with Britain's MI5 and blew the whistle on some very unsavory things going on. So stay tuned to KBOO for, I believe, Air Cascadia is next.
Yes, indeed. Air Cascadia coming up. Also this morning at 10:15 on Flashpoints, radio activist and Flashpoint senior producer Miguel Gavilan Molina tells his moving personal story of growing up in a farm worker family and experiencing racism. At 11 today on Between the Covers, host Dan Johnson interviews Oregon writer Christopher Lord about his book, The Edwin Drood Murders, the second volume in the Dickens Junction mystery series that began with the Christmas Carol murders. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, the hosts share their favorite books of 2013. That is all coming up, but first it is Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. That's coming up next on KBOO.
Tune in to Between the Covers every Thursday at 11 a.m. to hear interviews with locally and nationally known authors from both fiction and nonfiction. Between the Covers, only on KBOO Portland.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, December 5th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Well, there is a rally on the 10th to protect the Elliott timber stand from the depredations of Governor Kitzhaber and his crony timber barons. We've got a lot more on evergreen torture airplanes. If you think flying is bad now, Evergreen has stories to tell you. And of course, we'll be getting into talking